Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello, and welcome to another Quarantine edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely yet again by my Jedi Master co-host Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. This week we've got the post-World War II art drama, The Last Vermeer, a bizarre movie called The 20th Century, whose appeal Charlie will have to explain, the rom-com sequel The Princess Switch Switched Again, whose appeal I will have to explain to Charlie, plus a new documentary about the JFK assassination called The Truth is the Only Client, and possibly some other stuff too. Right, Charlie?
Well, Jedi Master is better than curmudgeonly. Maybe I'm a curmudgeonly Jedi Master. But happy pre-Thanksgiving. I know we're going to take next week off because there's not that there's a lack of films to watch, but Thanksgiving is a time to, according to the newspaper this year, stay home and duck and cover and catch up on podcasts. So to our listening audience, catch up on all of your podcasts next week while you're staying home away from friends and loved ones.
Well, hopefully you have some friends and loved ones in your home.
Well, we've been cooped up together so long, we're on different floors now. We just can't even look at each other.
Nice.
So
where are we starting?
We're starting with you because you're the only one who saw the week's biggest film on this podcast, The Last Vermeer. I'm familiar with Vermeer. We talked about, I think, a number of years ago, a documentary about Vermeer and allegedly how he created his works, especially involving something called the camera obscura. But tell me about this version of The Last Vermeer.
Well, this version, it's based on a 2008 book called The Man Who Made Vermeers by Jonathan Lopez. It's the true story of this guy named Han van Meegeren, who was a Dutch painter who pretty much made a name for himself, not as an artist, but as one of the most ingenious forgers of all time. And so in the immediate aftermath of World War II, his forgery skills pretty much almost got him executed because he had sold a bunch of supposed Dutch art treasures to Goering and other top Nazis, or so it appeared. And so pretty much this movie is kind of, it's part arty and part mainstream. Familiar elements of a lot of stuff we've seen before. I liked it okay, but I truly felt like I'd seen it before because the lead actor, Klaus Bang, is immersed in the art world yet again. We saw him maybe 3 months ago in The Burnt Orange Heresy.
Yeah.
He was in 2017's The Square.
Yeah.
So he does a bang-up job in all these movies, but I kind of feel like for him, let's put the paints away for a while. But he does not play Van Meegeren. He plays a guy named Joseph Piller, who was a Dutch Jew. He was a resistance fighter during the war, and he becomes an investigator tasked with identifying and redistributing stolen art, including an alleged Vermeer titled Christ with the Woman Taken in Adultery.
Whoa.
And there's all this evidence that starts piling up against Van Meegeren, but Piller and his assistant kind of start having doubts about the guy's guilt, and they devise this plan to prove his innocence in court, essentially to say, this was a forgery anyway that he sold to the Germans, and he really should be praised for, kind of pulling one over on them. And so that's really what this movie is about. It's a very soft R. I mean, I was actually kind of surprised to see that it was an R-rated drama. It shifts between being like really engaging and really dry. And so, the cast is really good. The performances are good. The movie is so-so. I think you would have liked it at least a little bit.
I agree. Sounds like, something I would have liked. Yeah, I believe your so-so review. I don't think I would have loved it, but I remember really liking The Burnt Orange Heresy from however many, you know, months ago that we saw it. I know it was during quarantine. And right. I really like The Square, so I'm all aboard, you know, Klaus Bong playing another, you know, art guy, art dealer, artist, whatever have you. But I'm not running out to see this.
No, but it's a little weird to just see Klaus Bang in yet another art film. I mean, it's just, I don't know, just seems to me like kind of a waste of his talents.
Or maybe it's his only talent. I mean, if it works and you know your range, you know what you're capable of, stay in your wheelhouse. Don't experiment.
I guess, but Han Van Meegeren is actually played by Guy Pearce, and he's really, he's quite kind of flamboyant, and he's quite a character in his own right in this film. So it's really the two of them carry most of it. Vicky Creeps plays the Pillar's assistant. And then actually one of my kind of favorite parts of this film is there's a supporting actor, Roland Miller, who plays Roland Mueller perhaps, who plays sort of this muscle man for Pillar named Esper Vesser. And he's just sort of like some comic relief and much needed. And he's, you know, he just has like, you know, when every once in a while, one of those supporting characters just gets the moments in the film that just make you smile. That's what he gets. So, you know, it's certainly, even though it's opening in theaters right now, I would say if you like the book, if you're a fan of art history, then this probably will offer some appeal, but it's absolutely worth waiting for a streaming option. And I would say too that it explores the notion of what is art anyway, which I think brings us, Charlie, to our next film that you saw and I watched 5 minutes of.
You only made it through 5 minutes?
Maybe a little more. Actually, I think I made it through 20. I think I actually went to the 20-minute mark before I was like, I just really am not feeling this one.
Hannah. For shame. Let's talk about the Canadian film, The 20th Century. And technically, this is a biography. William Lyon Mackenzie King existed. He was the 10th Canadian prime minister. And he's the longest serving prime minister at different times, but most of the 20s, a lot of the 30s, he was Canada's prime minister. And that's kind of where the history stops, and it takes a lot of liberties after that. So real guy, but then the rest of it is not so real. Now, do you remember last week we talked about the French New Wave with The Climb? You remember talking about that and how riveted you were with the French New Wave? All right, let's jump back into film class here, and let's talk about German Expressionism, which is what this film is. German Expressionism it's really early. We're talking 1910s and 20s and into the early 30s. If you ever heard of 1920s, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, I saw that movie. 1922's Nosferatu, 1927's Metropolis, Fritz Lang.
Nope.
This is all German Expressionism. German Expressionism is, you know, they're experimenting with these bold styles, these new ideas. They're making up for their micro budgets by using these crazy set designs, these non-realistic, wild, geometrically absurd set designs and angles with designs painted on the walls and the floors, you know, to represent light and shadow and objects. This is anti-realism. So I'm going to guess set design turned you off a little bit.
I just didn't know what I was watching. I had read that it was sort of a biopic, and then that's not quite what I felt like I was getting. It was just too weird for me. It's not a Hannah movie. It's a Charlie movie.
Yeah, written and directed by Matthew Rankin, we follow Mr. Mackenzie King, and he wants to become prime minister. And to do that, you don't do votes. Well, I'm sure they did back then, but in this movie, it is a test of skill, feats of Canadian strength. They do bird calls, they club baby seals, they pee their name in the snow in calligraphy, and whoever does, you know, the best at those becomes prime minister. Mackenzie King is this very overbearing mother, some real Oedipus thing going on there. She has dreamed it. He will become prime minister. He will marry this particular lady she has dreamed of, and it turns out the lady is the daughter of the Governor General, the British Governor General, you know, the Queen's, Her Majesty of England's representative in Canada. This is a fascinating film, Hannah. Apparently, we're allowed to make fun of Winnipeg. Everyone I get in Canada, I guess, makes fun of Winnipeg, and that's where you go if you have a particular sexual fetish, which Mackenzie King does, by the way, which may get in his way of becoming Prime Minister. Women play men in this film. Men play women. I had my tagline here is for the adventurous cinephile. If you're not afraid of certain films, this may be the most fun you have all year. I had so much fun watching this movie.
I'll tell you, I sent it to Artie Chick because I thought, okay, maybe I'm missing something here and I'm just too mainstream in my perspective and Artie needs to set me straight. And she went, Nope, I gave up too. So I think, you know, what should have been my clue, which I did not pay attention to before watching or requesting this screener, is the pullout sort of quote that they had that said, if auteurs David Lynch and Guy Maddin teamed up for a truly unbelievable biopic, shooting it through the lens of German expressionist cinema and pre-code Hollywood, the result would be the critically renowned The 20th Century. So that alone should have been my clue that I just was not necessarily going to be of the right mind to enjoy this film, certainly not to the extent that you did. But I still had that inkling that you were going to give it a positive review.
I honestly don't know if you can go into this film blind without knowing certain things about film history. I think, you know, to truly appreciate this film, you have to know what German Expressionism is and maybe seen one or two of those films. You have to know, I don't think you have to know about Canadian history. I don't know anything about Canadian history and I still laugh my butt off. I look stuff up later just to check on who was who, what was what. But, yeah, to appreciate the film, maybe, you know, if someone goes into this film blind and really enjoys it, let me know. But you have to have a pocketful, maybe a class on cinematic history to understand what's going on here to truly appreciate it. But it's funny, Hannah. I didn't even know why you didn't stick with it, just because the script is hilarious. This is a Canadian making fun of Canada. It's a satire. He's saying we're such national disappointments and we're such mediocrities. Let's become somebody. It's hysterical.
Well, I decided that I was going to go in the complete opposite direction and give myself that time back to watch on Netflix, The Princess Switched Again. Now, Charlie, I don't suppose you saw this one or the original The Princess Switch from, a year or two ago.
I didn't know there was an original Princess Switched, and this is probably the worst title of a film ever.
No, because The Princess Switch did really well, starring Vanessa Hudgens as two characters.
Is she the princess?
She is Duchess Margaret, and she is also the American Stacy.
Oh,
and
God.
In this movie, it's called Switched Again, because as you would imagine, Margaret and Stacy, who switched roles in the original, end up kind of switching roles again, basically because it's time to kind of, I'll give you the log line. So here it is. When Duchess Margaret, played by Vanessa Hudgens, unexpectedly inherits the throne to Montanaro and hits a rough patch with Kevin, who she hooks up with in the first movie.
Naturally.
It's up to her double, Stacy, from Chicago, also played by Vanessa Hudgens, to save the day before a new lookalike, party girl Fiona.
Oh, God.
Margaret's cousin, played by, who do you think?
I don't care.
Vanessa Hudgens.
Oh, thank God.
Tries to foil their plans. So in this movie, Vanessa Hudgens is sort of a triple threat. She's playing three roles. Three different voices. One is sort of upper crust British, and then American, and then the British cousin Fiona, who kind of sounds like Catwoman in Heat, is really what she looks like. It's a lot of like, but you know, I think there are parts. This has to be actually quite challenging for an actor and director. It looks pretty seamless. And it's just, I call it a, it's totally Hallmark style frothy flick. And I would say if you're seeking like a fluffy alternative to The Crown, this is it. It's silly, but it's harmless, way more superficial than something like The Princess Diaries, but a perfectly fine distraction. Nobody gets hurt. The girls are in charge. They are the Princess Charmings to their beaus. And the bad guys and gals are never really that bad. They're more like the bumbling villains that who get their comeuppance in the end. And what I liked was it reminded me, so within the context of this movie, it's Operation Get Dad Back Together with Margaret.
Oh my God.
And so I thought, well, it's better than Operation Christmas Drop. So there you have it. Long live the Queen. And the princess switched again. You know who you are, that this one's for. If you watch the first one, totally an easy watch. If you didn't, the film does start with one of those quick recaps to set the scene for you, and you could pick it up pretty darn quick.
Hannah, what hurts the most about all of this is, you know, you're talking up this movie, The Princess Switched Again, and you're like, it's an easy watch, and it doesn't hurt. And it's right after, it's juxtaposed with an audacious film like The 20th Century. And you're talking of this garbage, this Hallmark.
It's not garbage.
I wrote it on a yellow legal pad over the long weekend.
No, it's
yes,
better than
it's called The Prince and the Pauper. It's called The Prince and the Pauper, the first one. And then they switch The Prince and the Pauper again.
See, you haven't seen it, so you can't actually say that.
And I can.
So until
I can.
You've actually,
oh my God! I can't believe it. I have to defend an auteur film like The 20th Century to this Babysitter's Club, Nancy Drew. Oh my God!
As the saying goes, Charlie, one person's trash, even where cinema is concerned. So again, it's just there's like 5,000 Christmas movies out there right now, and this isn't better or worse than the majority of them.
It's like I just hear like German expressionism is hard, okay, and we have princesses here and they're switching again, so
I don't want hard. I don't want my brain to explode in the week before Thanksgiving when we're dealing with like the worst news possible all the time. I just want Vanessa Hudgens in a triple role playing a princess, and I think actually it's sort of like two princesses and a cousin. So, you know, hey, it's not for you, Charlie, just like The 20th Century is not for me.
Oh, it just hurts, Hannah. It just
sorry.
Stings.
I'm sorry.
Let's talk about a documentary. And I watched this and I immediately sent it to our executive producer, Joe Bordeaux, because can he be a Kennedy assassination aficionado? If you can, then he is it. I've been in his library before, and he's got one of those guys with floor to ceiling books on all the shelves, and half of them are about the Kennedy assassination. So I watched Truth is the Only Client, : the official investigation into the murder of John F. Kennedy. From what I know, and I came in, I was born 17 years after this happened. And I know Oswald. I know he was a troubled man. I know there was a book depository, and I know there are, I don't know what you would call it, conspiracies. Like, there's no way it was just Oswald. And I think I believed it. I think, well, there must be more. Maybe it was the Cubans. Maybe it was the Soviets. Maybe it was the Mafia. Maybe it was Johnson. Who knows? Could have been anyone. Could have been all of them. What this documentary does is it reconvenes, it reunites the surviving members of the Warren Commission. Now, no one actually on the commission is still alive. These are the guys who actually did the work, the staffers, just like Congress today. They bring along, you know, the staffers who are now considerably elderly. And there's some you will recognize. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Well, he's the only one I recognize. and they said, I know, they go through the evidence. They said, this is Oswald. This is where he came from. This is what he did. And that is very convincing. Once they're through, and that's the first half of the film, is who was Oswald? How did he do it? Why did he do it? Very convincing right through the first half that he had me. You're right, it was Oswald all alone. And then they debunk the theories. Okay, let's start with, was it the Soviets? Was it Fidel Castro? Was it the FBI? And they all have pros and cons. And, you know, they're very convincing that this is why it couldn't have been this particular set of people. Now, I've been reading online some truthers, some guys who know it was a conspiracy, and they are not taking kind to this, because you're never going to convince somebody who believes so fervently in a conspiracy that it was really just one disturbed guy. And this guy, you know, he would have been an active shooter today. Oswald was just that type of guy, and he's just a troubled guy. He's just a lunatic. I liked learning about his wife. I didn't know there was a wife, and I didn't know his living situation before he did it. I learned so much from this documentary, because they really don't teach you this stuff in school. And then the second half hit, and I started to get twitchy, because this is a 2-hour and 20-minute film, and it didn't need to be. It's bookended by this judge, this contemporary, somewhat young judge, who says, I'm really interested in this, and he gives himself the first and last word. Totally superfluous, totally unnecessary. Get this guy out of the film and chop 10 minutes off of it. And start editing the second half. Wait, I'm glad you mentioned the conspiracies, but you start beating a dead horse about why this and why that. Man, if they chopped a good half hour off this documentary, it would really be something. Then it would actually have weight and pack a punch. But as it is now, it gets long-winded, it gets draggy, and I started to lose interest in really who killed the president.
Yeah, no, I totally lost interest sort of midway through too, when I realized that that I'd been watching this thing for like 1 hour and 45 minutes, and that there was still so much more to go. And this movie is its own worst enemy with the running time, because I too did not really know about his living situation and his wife and child too, I believe, and the fact that maybe if his wife had sort of reconciled, sort of taking him in, taking him back from the situation they were living in, maybe he would have taken a different path. You know, they kind of raised that. So there were really some fascinating insights that I wasn't aware of, but they're buried in so many dull moments. And the narrator inserting himself into the narrative the way he did, it just drags it down even more. You know, it is releasing, it's coinciding with the weekend that I think it will mark 57 years since the assassination on November 22nd of 1963. So, you know, it wasn't as far removed from my inexistence as it was from yours. But there have been so many movies and documentaries and the, you know, the frame by frame analysis of the Zapruder film. And so, you know, this one had to have really been, it had to have done something really, really special and done it so incredibly well to sort of try and put itself into the mix of all these pre-existing documentaries on this subject. And I just don't think it does that. And it's a shame, because there are great little tidbits. They're just scattered and buried. And so therefore it's just really hard to appreciate what they are.
But I do appreciate a lot of it. It thoroughly debunks the magic bullet theory. You know, remember, mm-hmm. Seinfeld made famous the second spitter, because Governor Colony was sitting not in front of him, but to his left, and totally, okay, they did the three bullets where everything hit. This is the first time I ever saw the autopsy photos. Good Lord, that is visceral, seeing Kennedy's brain. I've never seen the Zapruder film analyzed frame by frame before, and you can really see where it hit, how it hit, and how Jackie O got covered in splatter.
I'd never seen all that before.
And mm-hmm. and I would always laugh and be like, oh yeah, you know, the magic bullet, and how did a bullet change direction in mid-flight? Well, it didn't, and they prove it. And so I'm sold on that now. That's not a conspiracy that would work anymore with me. But yeah, man, this film had so much potential if it wasn't for that silly second half.
Yeah, no, and you know, there are a couple other documentaries that are actually out this week too that we didn't see, but Artie Chick saw them. And there's the Belushi one on another John Belushi. I think it's on Showtime.
Well, me and the kid had our own little film festival this week. Remember, we had done Robin Hood and our 50s sci-fi thing. They've been reading about Sir Lancelot in school now for whatever reason. So we dived in. We had a Camelot film festival. We watched, naturally, the most famous one of that, Sword and Stone, Disney. Those songs hold up. I really enjoyed watching this again. It's only 80 minutes, so thank goodness. But I mean, it's pretty lazy. They use some voice stuff over and over again, and then there's some reused animation that I did not pick up on as a child. But Sword and Stone holds up. What does not hold up, and this is the first time I've seen it, was 1998's Quest for Camelot. I was graduating high school that year, so I was not paying attention to Quest for Camelot. What a god-awful movie. This might be the worst animated film I've ever seen. But you got Cary Elwes and Pierce Brosnan and Celine Dion singing songs. What a god-awful movie about a farm girl trying to find a lost Excalibur to save Camelot. It's so bad. And then I watched, with him, the Lego Star Wars Holiday Special, which is also out just this week on Disney Plus. It's 44 minutes. I really like these Lego things. They're usually quite funny, funnier than you think they would be. This one was not. It takes place almost immediately after what we saw last year, Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. So you got Rey and Finn and Poe and all those guys, and they're celebrating Life Day. That is a direct callback from the cult classic 1978 Holiday Special, which George Lucas tries to pretend doesn't exist, but everyone knows it does and still makes fun of it. There's a time portal that opens up, and they mix all these characters from like every episode, you know, all the way from young Anakin to young Luke Skywalker to the most recent trilogy, and they're mixing them all up just so, you know, it makes sure he gets everybody's every favorite movie in there for at least a couple seconds. No, not good. You can kind of skip the Lego Star Wars Holiday Special, even though, you know, if you have kids, throw it on over Thanksgiving, it won't hurt you.
Yeah, I actually even grabbed 47 minutes today to watch that one. And I certainly wouldn't be buying a subscription to Disney Plus just to see it. It only works if you watch everything Star Wars and you really just know all the inside jokes. The reason I called you a Jedi Master is one line I did hear from it was, even Jedi Masters need a day off, which is why I figured, you know, as we take off for Thanksgiving, that was a little good line.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but there's a lot better things this week than that thing. Go rewatch The Sword and the Stone. It's good for you.
Well, and when we talk about all the Christmas stuff on Netflix, there is a Dolly Parton special, Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, that comes out on Sunday on Netflix. And, you know, she's a national treasure. She helped bankroll one of the vaccines. And I just think she's making a real difference in the world. And so it's like, could you go, Dolly? She's been everywhere in the past few months. But I have a feeling because of that, Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square will be a highlight going into Thanksgiving for Netflix viewers.
Yeah, I'm not going to watch that.
And I did watch Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, which was also trending on Netflix, which, you know, actually, I think you and the kid might enjoy. It's sort of this musical adventure, kind of a visual spectacle for the ages. Very, you know, just a family holiday film.
For the ages, Hannah, though, is it for the ages?
No, that's from Netflix. They call it For the Ages. But, you know, I did like that it had Forest Whitaker and Keegan-Michael Key and Felicia Rashad and Anika Noni Rose. I mean, a really, you know, a strong cast. And it's just a, you know, it's just one of those nice family Christmas movies. And it just has that spectacular kind of look, very colorful, big sets, dancing, music, kind of like a little bit, you know, like The Greatest Showman kind of burst onto the streets and start singing kind of thing. And so I did enjoy that one. And I think it's just a good choice for, you know, just for family, true family viewing.
We haven't had Thanksgiving yet. I'm not ready for Christmas movies, even though I will make him watch The Muppet Christmas Carol again.
You know, you can never watch the Muppet movies too many times, so that's okay.
It's so, a rainbow
just
connection.
A reminder. Yeah. Are you going to sing?
Maybe afterward. The Rainbow Connection. What a wonderful song.
All right. Thank you. So we will be taking next week off for Thanksgiving and hopefully getting a running start on a slew of other movies coming out the following week. So, you know, and I think we actually did get The Croods, A New Age, the sequel to the 2013 movie is coming out. I don't know if you're going to watch that one.
I don't know.
Maybe, you know, it's
I like the first one.
It's got a good cast. Yeah, the first one was cute. You know, Nicolas Cage, Emma Stone, Ryan Reynolds. You know,
but it looks like new characters. Are they? I don't think they're coming back.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I'd have to look at the trailer. It didn't look like the same characters to me.
See, that would be my only reason for
because it's the Croods, a new age.
Maybe it's a new brood.
Yeah,
a new brood of Crood.
Saved by the Bell, the new class.
Oh, great. And then there's one called Uncle Frank that's set in 1973 with an uncle and his 18-year-old niece driving from New York to South Carolina for a family funeral. So, you know, hey, that could be a really interesting Thanksgiving family fare. I don't know, but that's probably an R-rated one, if I recall. So very different adult drama road trip movie, Uncle Frank.
Yeah, maybe Uncle
Frank. So maybe when we get back, we can talk about those if either of us has seen either of them.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Okay. Well, I think we'll probably catch up. I'm going to do some more Camelot films. We're not done yet. There's more to hop into there, I think. I mean, but, you know, he can't watch the early Excalibur because there's stuff going on there. He can't watch First Night, you know, RIP Sean Connery, not ready for that yet. So we got to still play it safe.
All right. Well, you know, take it one day, 1 year at a time with the kid and one Excalibur film at a time.
Excalibur.
So it gives you something to look forward to in the years ahead. So, all right, sounds good. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of Cinema Clash. Thanks as always for listening. If you have a question, if you have a comment, you can reach us at The Cinema Clash on Twitter or thecinemaclash.com. Till next time, stay safe and have a happy and healthy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Indeed.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.